right, friends, Greg Kokel here, top of the hour to you, and thank you for being my guest. I got a whole bunch of callers on board, and somebody from Australia is calling in later, so they're not even on board yet. So I'm not going to have opening commentary here. I'm just looking to see if I have something to announce to you. I'd already mentioned last time around that the Standard Reason podcast is now available in video format on our YouTube channel. So if you go to str.org and then go down to the bottom and check out, you know, they got the YouTube deal and all the social media stuff. You can go there for that. And let's see, what else? And I told you last time around about all the dates for the upcoming reality conferences. I almost said Rethink. And if you go to rethinkapologetics.com, realityapologetics.com. realityapologetics.com, and you're going to get all the skinny on that. One more thing, and I don't mention this very often, but we do have an ad about it. We are kind of getting into our swing now for this year because of all of the fallout from last year. We haven't been doing personal events. We've been doing a lot of Zoom things. All of us are available for new things, except for Tim Barnett, who's stuck in his house. He can do Zoom things, and he's doing those things, but if you want to schedule a Standard Reason speaker, just contact Darcy@str.org, and she will set you up, okay? And talk to you about what your needs are and who best can satisfy the needs, whether it's Alan Schliemann or I almost said Tim Barnett, but who knows? In a couple months, he may be in play as well. We hope so. We want to get him out of there where he's stuck, and we definitely are going to work something out for him for the fall reality conferences. But it may be John Noyes. He's specialized in the area of suicide and fabulous need right now to hear talks on that. And Alan, of course, does all the things that he does on same-sex issues, homosexuality, gender, Islam, abortion. I mean, he's got all the dangerous topics. And I do tactics and a whole host of other things, too. So just give Darcy not a ring, but a note. darcy@str.org. A lot of time open in the summer and the fall, and love to hear from you. Okay. So let's go right to our callers. Here is Kevin in, gosh, man, those red buttons. Stay away from those. There we go. In Columbus. I presume, Kevin, that's Columbus, Ohio. Yeah. Did you call a couple weeks ago?
I did.
Because I was going to recommend a church to you. It's a huge, giant church that was founded by a couple of guys I knew in the Jesus movement many, 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 many years ago. But now I'm trying to, it's a Greek word, and I'm trying to remember the name
Zenos?
Of it.
Zenos?
Pardon me? Zenos. Zenos Christian
That's
Fellowship.
That's it. That's my church.
No kidding. Gary DeLashmit.
DeLashmit and, the other guy. They're kind of retired now.
I knew Gary when he had hair.
Yeah.
He had a lot of hair. Red hair.
I'm gonna next time I see him, he's been teaching our a Revelation series recently on our Sundays. So
Gary and then
the other guy.
Yeah, other guy. Oh nuts, I'll get it before long. Yeah. Zenos Christian Fellowship, and they've got churches all over that city now.
We changed our name to Dwell.
Dwell?
Yes.
Okay, maybe that'll be easier for me to remember, but yeah, they were great guys, and I mean, I was a year old in the Lord, not even a year old in the Lord, when I met those guys. We hung out together for a couple of years, and then they went back to do their thing in Ohio, where they were from, and they have been faithful workers for all of these decades, so good for you.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So I work, I'm a state of Ohio employee, about going on 18 years now, and I've seen on my son's counseling company, psychologists, where on their email signatures, it'll say Sharon Smith, preferred pronouns, she and her.
Yeah.
And I can perceive where the wind's blowing with this.
Yes.
And I work for the state. If they would try to force me to do something like that, would I be justified in your eyes in saying no and forcing them to fire me?
Well, I would say you're more than justified. You are borderline obligated to say no, and I'll tell you the reasons in a moment. They should not be justified in firing you. It is almost impossible to fire a state employee for anything. And for them to fire you because you don't list your preferred pronoun on your own correspondence is absolute. It's not only nonsense, it's shameful. All right.
But that's the world we live in.
No, I know, but this is the world we have to say no to. Okay, so let me give you my point of view on this, and then I'll let you guys can decide for yourself, because you know you have to. I have written about this in the last Solid Ground. Do you get Solid Ground in the mail or email or whatever?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So the one that came out 2 months ago, which is called the Primal. Did I put it in that or not? Or maybe I just put it in the one that just came out May 1st. So this is called Freedom Fading. And I talk about it there. And then I've written a mentoring letter just on pronouns that's coming out in June 1st. Okay? Mm-hmm. But I'll tell you what I said there. Because to put it in perspective, I start out by saying, hey, you know, what's the big deal? Why don't we just go along with it? You know, what's the big deal? It is a big deal if they're going to fire you for not using the right pronoun in your own correspondence. They have made it a big deal. And why? Because this is the skirmish line in a battle of worldviews. And it's not a live and let live idea. It is not like, well, they have their worldview and I have mine. That would be fine. That's not their view. They have their view. And it is a contentious, divisive, controversial, political view. Okay, these words are important. It's contentious, it's divisive, it is controversial, and it's political. And your employer is going to force their political view on you under threat of cancellation for you and your livelihood? Okay, so I'm trying to make it as clear as possible how completely abusive and bizarre this is. Now, I have a solution for this that ought to work, and it's in the letter, but I'll let you know in advance, okay? And other people have already been using it. If you are asked to put your preferred pronoun at the end of your correspondence, here's what you put. I do not have a preferred pronoun. I have a sex. I'm male, for instance, in your case. That's it. Now, keep in mind what they're asking you to do. They are asking you to self-identify. You have just done that. You have self-identified. You have identified with your physical sex, and you have not contributed to the lie that your gender is in your head. Gender and sex are synonyms. As far as I'm concerned, that's my worldview. Okay? They don't think so. They think gender and sex are separate because gender is in your head and sex is in your body. Okay? I don't agree with that worldview. I think it's false. I think it's obviously false. But if they want to believe it, they're welcome to believe it. What they are not welcome to do is force me to act like I believe it. And that's what's going on. And so that's why I think if you say, I don't have a preferred pronoun, I have a sex, I'm male, you are taking a modest stand. Now, maybe really bug them, but this is modest. This is such a small step to say no, that they have made such a big deal. The fact that they're making it such a big deal tells you how much is at stake for them with regards to worldview. And if we don't say no now, where are we going to say no? When they start taking our kids away? And I am not speaking hyperbolically.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I'm preparing myself now. You know, because when big decisions I think are on the way, I'm preparing myself now how I'm going to react.
Yeah.
But when it does happen, I'm not going to flinch.
Okay. So now what I suggested for you, I think, is completely defensible, because you are not taking a shot at their system, you are not criticizing anybody else, you are not saying anybody else is wrong, you only are refusing to play in their system. Since they ask you for your self-identification, you self-identify by your sex, not by any preferred pronoun, because in your mind, preference has nothing to do with it. Okay, so if they take exception to that, the question could be asked, why is this not acceptable? And I want to hear what they have to say. Why is this not acceptable? Why are you using your power as an employer over me to force me into your political categories? What if I demanded that everybody that is under me in the business must wear, MAGA caps, Make America Great Again caps? Is that going to be okay? Would that be all right with you guys? No, of course not. This is totalitarianism expressed in this particular little slice of life. And you're calling me because you're concerned about the threat of being fired for using the wrong pronoun. That's over the top.
Or just refusing to go along with it.
Yes. I suggest you do not say my preferred pronoun is male because you're cisgendered. Okay? Do you know what I mean by cisgendered?
Not really.
Okay, the word cisgender, this is part of the vocabulary of the movement. Cisgender means that your gender identity is the same as your physical sex. So if you have a penis and you believe you're a male, you are cisgendered. If you have a penis and believe you're a female, you're transsexual. Okay? Or whatever the terminology is now. It's hard to keep track of all of this. But I'm not only cisgendered, I'm cisgendered normative. I mean, that's the right way to be. That's the way God made us. And if we believe we're a woman trapped in a man's body, then there's something wrong with the way we think. There's nothing wrong with our bodies. Now, I'm telling you this and to the rest of the listeners, but I'm not going to preach that at the boss and all that. I'm going to live and let live. If this is the direction you want to go, I'm not going to try to change you, but I am going to resist you trying to change me. That was what I said a little bit earlier. We can't change the world, but we can demand that they not change us.
Right.
So there's a cost here that's involved, and this is where I think this is where we have to stand up and say no. And if you have threat, then you call the Alliance for Defending Freedom or for the Defense of Freedom. What is it? ADF? Is it defending or defense? Something like that. And ask for an attorney. And there's other organizations that do the Christian Legal something or other. There's a number of organizations. And just say, okay, well, we're going to sue. I'm going to take this to court. And if enough Christians or people, it doesn't have to be Christian, who don't want to be pressed into this mold illicitly, take these people to court, they will stop doing it. I promise you. Pardon me?
I was going to say, if the Equality Act passed, it won't matter if we...
Then we have to fight. Then we still have to oppose the Equality Act. That Equality Act, I don't see how it could possibly stand constitutional muster. But this is another. This is what you're describing first in your call is called soft totalitarianism. The Equality Act is hard totalitarianism. This is just as bad as the Aryan paragraph in 1934 under the Hitler and the Third Reich. These are laws being passed that are abusive to human freedom. They are totalitarian, and every single time one is passed without resistance, they pass more. These people are never satisfied. Never.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember seeing you may have seen this, there was a lesbian black woman, I can't remember her name, but she said she was a manager of she owned a magazine, and she said this has been there. The movement LGBTQ, it's been there. They wanted in just a little bit way back in then. It was like I forget what it was. Mm-hmm. They got some kind of law ruled their way, but they said that's what they wanted people on the outside to think that's all they wanted. But their intentions was to take everything over.
Yes.
Because once we let them in, we can't say no to something else. because we just said yes to that.
Exactly.
It would be contradictory.
Right. These people are bullies. They are the biggest bullies on the planet. Ironically, they are the authors of the anti-bullying stuff. But all that is meant to make it easier. It is to protect homosexuality. So if you raise any objection, this is considered bullying. But they will bully people who don't agree with them, and they do it. This is what cancel culture is all about.
Yeah.
What you're experiencing is bullying. Okay. Now there's only one way to deal with a bully, and that's to knock them down. You know, every playground has a bully. How many people like the bully? Just the bully and his buddies. Nobody else likes him, but they're all quiet because they don't want to get bullied further until somebody stands up and says no, draws a line in the sand and says no. Now, they might get their nose bloodied, but now the bully knows it's going to cost them something to bully, and other people are going to stand up against them too. Okay, and I'm using figurative language when I talk about nose bloodied. Mm-hmm. I mean, for the most part, although I do think that some Christians do get their nose literally bloodied by saying no. But this is what we're facing. And we have to tell these bullies, no, you are not going to push us around. And if we have to go to law, we'll go to law. And it's going to cost them to continue this nonsense. And if it's the government that's doing it, this is what the Third Reich government did, the same stuff. This is what the Solid Ground that I just wrote, that just came out, is all about. And I have all these examples in there. And the next one I'm writing this week is on critical race theory, and this is just another example of authoritarian, not just authoritarian, but the that kind of behavior.
I'm thinking so far ahead. What would my life be like if I was to just sit down and go along with it? I would feel miserable. I would feel weak. I would feel like a coward, and that is no way to live. I'd rather be unemployed than to feel like all those things.
Yeah. Well, there you go. And I appreciate that you're counting the cost, because this is necessary. And John Noyes was telling me just the other day, one of our speakers on staff here, is that the church has to start organizing itself in a way to give support to those who say no. And this may mean financial support. You know, the community comes around, because this is happening everywhere. And it's just a tidal wave that's going on right now. And if we don't put now people are putting their feet down. There are more and more people saying no. And the so-called resistance, some have identified themselves as that. It's the Alliance for Defending Freedom, ADF.
Dennis McCallum is the person you were thinking of.
Dennis McCallum, of course. He wrote an interesting book on apologetics about 30 years ago, too, or 25 years ago.
Discovering God.
Look, Kev, I've got to go. So say hi to my Jesus freak buddies, if you ever bump into them. And thank you for your call and for your courage.
Yep.
Okay, brother.
Thank you. All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We're going to skip commercials here. We just got so many people to talk to. So let's see. In Washington State, I presume. Matt, welcome to the show.
Hey, Greg. Good to talk to you. First-time caller, long-time listener.
Well, glad you called.
Your relativism book was the first foray I had into apologetics in college back in the late 90s, and been going strong ever since. So God bless you for all you do. I'm a strategic partner.
Thank you.
Just all all kinds of gushing good feelings toward you.
Well, thank you. That's really sweet. In 1998, that book came out. Frank and I did that book. Yeah, that was my first published book. So
I was blessed to have a mentor that suggested that to me, and I hit the ground running from there.
Yeah, well, good. Well, unfortunately, that book is still as timely today as it was 12 years ago or 13 or 23 years ago now, I guess. So it's good news, bad news, I guess.
Yep, agreed. Well, I had a question for you today. And it's about forgiveness.
Okay.
I haven't been able to get a straight answer from you know, my pastor and different, you know, sites and places I've been looking.
Mm-hmm.
When someone has done something to you that they are not sorry for,
mm-hmm.
I'm wondering how that can be resolved with you know, the most general response is, well, you need to let it go. You need to forgive them. And I sort of understand what they mean, you know, to the sense that it's eating you up inside, mm-hmm. that kind of stuff, that mm-hmm. it's emotionally helpful. But I'm looking on it as a purely, you know, how can one be forgiven that doesn't want to be? I mean, presumably God doesn't forgive us, you know, if we don't actually want it. Like,
right. I think this is a little bit of a tricky question. And the reason is because I think the issue of forgiveness is there are a couple of different angles to it in Scripture. Now, one of my mentors, Doug Guyvett, philosopher over at Biola, wrote a piece or a chapter in a book about this. And his point was that your responsibility to forgive another a transgression is dependent upon their willingness to admit their wrongdoing, and so and in a sense turn from it. In fact, Jesus made comments to this. If he repents, then forgive him. Well, how many times? 7 times? No, 70 times 7.
Yeah.
You know, but there are conditions there. It's not unconditional. And so I think there's a point there, all right, that is that you are not going to give the person the sense that they are released from their guilt if they are not repentant of their behavior, okay? So the reason part of this is, there's another part to this I want to mention, but part of it, this is so weird, is that how do we release somebody else from the guilt when they're really guilty before God more than anything else? So it's, I don't quite understand how all that works, but if you were to sin against me badly, and I would say, then you're not forgiven for what you did because you're not repentant about it. Okay, period. Now, that's kind of the judicial side of it. Let's just call it that. Then there is that personal side. If what I am doing, in light of the fact of the absence of your request for forgiveness and your subsequent repentance, which would result in my forgiveness by obligation, I am seething over it. And I'm turning it over, and I'm dwelling on it. I'm saying, you dirty rat, you know, you're doing this, you did that. Oh, man, I just, and over and over and over. This simply is soul-destroying. And I'm thinking of relationships I've been in where I find myself for things that were done that were wrong to me and for which there is not the hint of repentance. No sense that there's been any impropriety. And I'm going, oh, my gosh, and over and over and over. And this is where I got to go to God and say, okay, God, I'm stopping doing this. I'm just not going to do that. This is my self-talk. So maybe this is what is being spoken of when people say you just have to let it go. Yeah, there are times when a person is not going to repent. Maybe they're dead. They can't undo. They can't repent. They can't say they're sorry. None of that stuff. Now what? You can't. It is foolish to let those things continue to eat away at your heart. And this is where, you know, whatever is true, whatever is honorable or is right, whatever is good, whatever is lovely, and anything worthy of praise, blah, 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 any excellence, let your mind dwell on these things. And so this is where you have to go just for your own mental health.
And I have completely done that. It's more of a, you know, it strikes me as somewhat, you know, unserious of someone to say you should forgive someone something horrible that they aren't actually sorry about.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm like that, you know, that that wound is real. I don't want to minimize that by pretending that everything is forgiven when it's not even capable of,
sure,
of me granting that.
Okay,
though I harbor nothing emotional tied to it, I still want to keep that distinction.
Well, I think according to what Doug Guyvet has written, that's a legitimate distinction. The person is not forgiven. They're not released. Jesus said, forgive as you've been forgiven. Well, we're forgiven as we go before God and ask for cleansing and that kind of thing. Now, I don't think we're forgiven sin for sin in that way. It's the idea that we go and confess we are sinners and then we are cleansed and made whole and that kind of thing. But nevertheless, the dynamic is in place. And so I guess I could say, well, I am not, in a sense, forensically offering forgiveness to that person. The slate isn't clean. You haven't dealt with that. That has not been resolved yet. However, I am not going to ruin my life over the fact that you refuse to acknowledge your wrongdoing. I'm moving on emotionally. So that's the kind of twofold element, I think, that it's probably healthy to keep in mind.
Thank you, Greg.
Does that make sense?
I appreciate that very much. Yes.
Yeah. I think it's a tough situation, you know. It's one of those, how would I call it? Like, it's just a tough situation. That's all. It's sticky, you know. I wish it was cleaner than that. But, I mean, that's the scripture says if somebody repents, then forgive them. That's the forensic item. But dwelling on it and driving yourself crazy is no good. All righty?
Yeah. Thank you, Greg. I appreciate it.
Okay, good talking to you, Matt. God bless you, too. I appreciate that. All right. Man, real things here. Okay, moving right along. No breaks this hour, it looks like, to New Jersey. And Saru, did I say the name right?
Yes, Mr. Kupo.
Is it Saru?
Yeah, it's Saru.
Saru. Okay, Saru.
Yeah.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. My question was about a Christian's, I guess, role in politics. Like, the context of it is, I don't know if you've heard of everything that's going on in Colombia.
Who? I heard of who?
In Colombia. Have you heard of, like, this political situation right now?
No, I'm not familiar with that.
Well, it's really bad. So I hear Christians on one side saying that Christians shouldn't be involved in politics and they should just, pray and then leave it in God's hands. Oh. And then on the other side, I see Christians that are, like, going to, like, the protests and everything. But at the same time, I feel like they're also falling right into that trap of, the socialist movement that's been trying to take power. So I'm not sure where to stand in the middle of that.
Okay. I had a conversation with my daughter the other day about something along this line. Actually, it had to do with moral dilemmas and whether it's ever right to lie. And so I was talking about scriptural things that where I think it is. There are times when it's the right thing to do to lie because there's a greater moral good in view. And I'm looking for the book verse in Proverbs where it talks about those who are being led away to slaughter, for example. Okay, I'm looking for it right now. It's those who are being led away to slaughter. And what are we going to do? We are going to just be quiet. This is what the writer of Proverbs is saying. You know, how can you let people be carried away to slaughter or whatever? Now, I think this has an appropriate application to the abortion question. But more broadly, if we are going to act when injustice is being done to people, what is the way that we act? In other words, what is the means that we use to stop injustice of any kind? And there's a lot of conversation now about the issue of injustice, okay, racial injustice, for example. So how are we to stop these injustices? Well, the New Testament teaches that Caesar does not bear the sword for nothing, but he is the government is a means, an agent to end harm. Actually, the writer says an agent of revenge there, paying evil for evil. I should say rewarding the good and punishing the evil, okay? So if the government has the responsibility to do that, and we are facing many injustices, then and we are supposed to act to deal with injustice, doesn't it make sense that we may take advantage of the tool that God has ordained to establish justice and use it to accomplish the justice we're responsible for seeing done? I mean, that's common sense. Why? I found my verse, by the way. It's verse 11 of chapter 24 of Proverbs. Deliver those who are being taken away to death and those who are staggering to slaughter. Oh, hold them back. Okay? So that's just one example of an injustice that we have a moral obligation to address. What's the best way to address it? Well, the means that God has offered to us to accomplish that, and that is through government. How do we get involved in government? We get politically active. We vote. We run for office. I honestly don't understand, Saru, why some Christian, on the basis of which, what basis a Christian would argue that we should not be involved in politics. Politics
the,
is...
The reasoning I've heard is that politics corrupts. So they're like, you, a Christian, should stay away from it because they're going to be corrupted by the world. So
everything is corrupt in the world. Every profession, every enterprise, no matter what. The church is corrupt, for goodness sake, in some ways. It's made with corrupt people. Now, I mean, I'm not putting down the church. I'm just saying if that's one's rationale, well, you shouldn't get involved in that because it's corrupt. Well, then maybe you shouldn't be involved in anything. And by the way, what's the best way to deal with corruption in a group? Is to get in there and uncorrupt it with uncorrupt people, right? Duh. Oh, it's really, obviously you can tell I'm a little bit frustrated. Because this is silly. This is just silly. Christians shouldn't be involved in politics. Why? We've given the vote. We have an opportunity to make a difference. Why not make a difference for good in the way we use our influence in our culture, especially when we have a moral obligation to pursue justice?
And then how would we prevent ourselves from going to the other extreme that I see Christians going into, like with the social justice movement and like talking about how like Jesus would be advocating for the poor and like equality and, you know?
Well, the answer to that question generally is to have a biblical understanding of the role of government and the responsibilities that we have to others. Do you know that the Mosaic Law says that we should not favor the poor in judgment? That is in the Pentateuch. That was a law that the Jews had to follow. You do not favor the poor in judgment. Now, you help the poor, but when it comes to issues of justice, you don't give them a break over and against the so-called rich person. That's not just. That's right there in the text. Okay? So the way to answer that issue is that you have a balanced biblical worldview regarding the issues in question. You make sure that whatever political influence you are trying to have, it is consistent with biblical teaching. Now, there are going to be times when you're dealing with, say, a party, and there's pros and cons to each party. Well, this is where you're going to have to make a judgment. Look at the platforms, and do the platforms reflect, which platform best reflects a biblical morality? That's the question you have to ask yourself. And these are not always easy to unravel, these issues. But I think it's a foolish, foolish point of view that Christians should not be involved in politics, quote-unquote, because that's saying that Christians should not have an influence for good in when they have an opportunity to do it. It says in Proverbs, you know, right in chapter 3, why do you withhold good from whom it is due when it's in your power to do it? That's chapter 3, verse 27. Do not withhold good from those to whom it is due when it's in your power to do it. We have the power because we have suffrage, we have voting, we can make our voice known. And if we don't, guess who gets to rule? All the other people. And then they force laws upon us that are unjust, like the so-called Equality Act. So there you have it.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much.
Okay. You're welcome. Sorry I'm being quick here, just because we got a bunch of callers on board here. So let's see who, Mike and Tassie. Okay. Let's go to Tassie and Michael in Tasmania. Is this my fishing buddy, Mike?
Yeah, it is, buddy. How you doing?
I'm doing okay. You know, I don't know if I said this on the air last time, but I said it off the air. When you and I were fishing in Tassie, fly fishing for trout in that skinny, skinny water, I remember you crawling under a fence that was electric fence, and you got poked pretty good. Do you remember that?
Man, my weight is still remember it. There's still a hole there.
What's that?
There's still a hole in my waders from this poke.
You got boomed. But I also remember one other thing. There was a beautiful brown trout that you were trying to catch, but you couldn't see the fish. You made the presentation from where you were at. I was looking at over the bushes in another spot, and I could see the fish take the bait. And I signaled you to set the hook, and that's how you caught that fish. So it was a team effort.
It was. I was looking at, by the way, congratulations. Good anniversary. If you've got any doubts about your reach and the effect, just look at your call list today. It's unreal.
Oh, wow. No. Tasmania, there you go.
yeah. No, it's good. I was actually thinking, I've got to go fishing with Greg soon, but I don't know how we're going to pull that off. You know, COVID's just locked up our borders here in Aussie, really, so it's a bit tough. But anyhow.
Well, so even the Black Plague passed after it killed a quarter of the population of Europe, so we'll see. Maybe I'll still be around when this thing blows over. I'll come on and see you again.
Maybe the next 28th. Yeah, that'd be awesome. Maybe we could even do some talks between fishing.
Yeah. The next 28 years. Yeah, we'll see. I'll be 99, but we'll see.
That's all right. I've known some good fishermen in 99. Hey, last time I called, I completely stuffed up the timing. So, oops. So I thought I was calling at the end of the first hour, but it was the end of the second, so I didn't really get time to go through it. Now, what we were talking about is just how to reach young people and get through them. The you suggested the inside-out tactic, which I use. It's brilliant. But the problem is actually time. My daughter, who's at uni in Wollongong up in the mainland, they all got evacuated from their accommodation at 2:30 in the morning, and she just told me the most amazing thing. She's sitting there listening to literally hundreds of students. There wasn't a single conversation that wasn't mediated by reference to social media. Nobody walked up to somebody else and said, hey, how are you doing? You know, it's 2:30 in the morning. We just got rushed out of bed. It was all, hey, have you seen this post? Did you see that like this?
Right,
whatever.
Right.
And you know, that ridiculously short attention span, you know, watching Rachel, my youngest daughter, flick through her stream. Honestly, it's milliseconds and she's flicking. And I'm like, oh, wow, how do we keep their attention just long enough to have these discussions? You know, Katie's twin, Louie, is doing intersectionality as a part of nursing, believe it or not. And, you know, I was talking to her about an essay she wrote about it just recently, and it occurred to me that intersectionality, you know, if you use it in a good way, helps you understand people, sure. But the way it's being taught and the way it's being used is actually sort of enshrining the concepts of genetic fallacy as a reasonable way to do things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you only have voice if you're from here, or you definitely don't if you're from there, or you're a male or a female.
Right.
These things aren't short-term. Like, they're not something you can do in a millisecond tweet. And I love the work that you're doing with Tim. The Red Pen Logic is utterly sensational. But it just got to be thinking, how do I help these discussions when they happen?
Okay,
there's no time.
Okay, I have a thought about this, it might not be encouraging. It may or may not. I don't know. But no matter what era we're in, human beings are still human beings. They may be addicted to the social media, flash, 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 quick, quack, quick, TikTok, 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 you know, short things. But that doesn't mean they don't watch long things. So we had, Wonder Woman 1984, WW 1984 on. My 13-year-old likes it. She was riveted for, 2 hours or whatever it was.
Yeah.
Okay. We didn't have to keep changing channels. The information, the stuff held her interest, okay? So the way we do it with youth now is not keeping flashing new stuff. We just make stuff really interesting. Now, when we do our reality conferences, we have the advantage of having really, really good talent, people who communicate really well. With the exception of me, have great PowerPoint presentations, right? And so they're up there on the screen doing their thing. That's great. And this abets their talk. But their talks are the thing that engages people. And nobody's looking at their watch because the speakers are interesting and they're giving them information that is well-organized and clear. Plus, their energy level is up. I do not consider myself a very good communicator to youth. But Sean McDowell, who's great, he said, you do great, Greg. And that's because I amp it up when I'm with them. I try to be really clear. I throw the ball so they can catch it. And I keep my energy levels up. Okay. And I haven't had any problem with the times that I've gone talking with kids. And it isn't like they're flipping through their phones and they're waiting for another TikTok approach from me. So I think what this has done, the way everything's kind of visual and all the social media stuff, is it has required Christian communicators to be more at the top of their game, okay? But the fact is, anybody will give anything attention that is interesting to them, and they'll do it for a long, long time.
Yeah, it's true. I suppose the thing that I've seen happen a few times that just frustrated me is, you present a position or, you talk about something that's they just considered done, same-sex marriage or transsexual concepts. They look at you like, why are you even talking about this? And then pass off. It is frustrating.
This is because they're not interested. They're just not interested in talking about it, I suspect. And so they're not interested in the topic. So, and that's a problem because they've been socialized to accept a whole bunch of ideas as non-controversial. And when you start to suggest something different, then they're not going to pay attention to it. A lot depends on the relationship. I mean, parents, let me back up and put it this way. Kids don't want to listen to parents. Period. All right?
Yeah.
That doesn't mean parents shouldn't be talking to their kids. And the things that parents say to their kids oftentimes will sink in if you do it graciously and not a lot of negatives, like you got a nasty attitude and you're condescending and you're putting people down, especially your own kids. My dad had a huge influence on my life, and I remember particular things that he said time and time again. But my dad traveled a bit, and he wasn't around all the time, and he was kind of harsh in a lot of ways. But he still had a good impact on my life. And so when it comes to our own kids, there's certain things we sit them down and say, look, I'm going to tell you this, and I want you to understand it. Now, we don't, if they're not interested, we don't give them an hour lecture. We speak clearly and succinctly 5 minutes, and they get it. And then we may revisit that a couple days later. You have to give it to them in segments that they can manage if they're not interested. But you're the dad, and so you can, in a certain sense, force feed it to them because they got to sit there and learn from you. And by the way, parents have to do that, or kids won't learn anything.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, luckily we don't have that issue. It's not our kids that I'm struggling with. It's more, honestly, it's more the their friends that they're interacting with. And watching, I mean, our youngest is really, we can see her heading towards leadership for youth.
Yeah.
And how's she going to keep doing it? So it's, yeah. the topic, I think it's actually, you know, I've pointed her at Red Pen Logic and Tim and his funny face, and you know, she loves that, and it's good. And that is short, but it's just one of those topics that's sort of gnawing at the back of my mind, watching society live by lies.
Mm-hmm.
It's insane.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy. Well, and one other thing, a suggestion I make to you, Mike, is that, excuse me, is that you ask questions. I mean, I sound like a broken record,
always.
Mike, but you ask questions. So you're going to ask, this is one way to get kids more involved, because if you're preaching, of course, then they get bored. But if they're talking, that's different.
Yeah.
And so asking questions is a... is a simple way of getting people to
engage.
Yeah, I guess a simple way to put it. All right.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Hey, maybe we should try and get reality down to Australia.
Yeah, well, that's hard enough to do it here,
I know.
But look, if you guys want to put something together and you get a group out, we'll send some people out. I mean, we're open to doing that. Okay. Kyle's
we'll
giving a thumbs up. I don't know what you're going to do there, Kyle. He wants to go to Tassie. Okay. I hope it works out someday. Take him fishing. Okay. He'll get strung up on one of those electrical wires, man, and he won't be happy about that. All right, Mike, thanks. See you, buddy.
God bless you, man. Talk to you later.
Bye-bye. All righty, let's see. Oh, goodness gracious. That was a fun fishing trip. And skinny water, when I say skinny water, that means shallow. So I'm in a pasture, there's trees all over the place, and it's about 3 inches deep, or four, maybe five. And I still caught some fish. But try fly fishing in there. You got to have room for a back cast, or unless you use a roll cast. And well, there's tricks you can do, but anyway. All right, let's go to Phoenix and Leland. Hello, Leland.
Well, hi, Greg.
How you doing?
Oh, I'm doing okay. I'm still surviving. It's been interesting since 2009, but I was living in California up until between 91 and 2011.
Mm-hmm.
And got out of there for about 3 years and came back for 3 years. But I just wanted to call. I think I've been listening to you almost since you started broadcasting, even before you started Stand to Reason.
That's right. We started Stand to Reason in 1993, and I started broadcasting in February 1990. So there's like a three-year difference, whatever. So
Yeah. And I just had started getting back into religion at the time, and I thought I was finding Christ, but once I moved to California, I found a church. I started going to church and actually reading the Bible once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then I discovered something called apologetics.
Mm.
And while I did not initially come to faith by reason, I think it is by reason that I have stayed with the faith, and
mm-hmm.
You were the biggest part of, you know, I mean, there were a multitude of people in Southern California at the time doing apologetics,
mm-hmm.
and I went to as many as I could, but you were the one that I would listen to every week, and you were the one that introduced me to a lot of the other people, and you just ended up being probably having the most influence, more influence than any other one person at that time in my coming to age as a Christian. And I just wanted to thank you for your ministry. I've been following you for about 30 years, I guess.
Wow.
And just wanted you to know that you have had a profound effect on people.
Hmm. Well, Leland,
I appreciate that.
Yes, it's very satisfying to hear that. And I deeply appreciate your comments. And, you know, this is like singles and doubles just showing up, as I said last hour, actually, and just blooming where you're planted. So then God has an opportunity to use the efforts that we offer him. And I'm really satisfied that and gratified that we've had an impact in your life, and will, God willing, continue to do so. So thank you, Leland.
I hope I could pass that on to others. I've been trying. I even tried to pass my turn at pastoring. I wasn't ready for it, and I was also at the time doing working at a day job for 50 hours plus a week. But I'm active with every apologetics group I can find. I'm now here in Phoenix and active with an apologetics group for what it's worth here.
Uh-huh.
You just have a multitude of what you used to call clear-thinking Christian cadets out there.
Yeah, so. That's right. An army of clear-thinking Christian cadets. Well, thanks so much, Leland. I got one more caller I got about 8 minutes for right here, but it's so sweet of you to give me a call and say what you said.
Well, God bless.
All the best to you, brother. Bye-bye now.
All right. Bye-bye.
And Carly, Augusta, Georgia, you made it.
Hi. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You can hear me all right. I've got you on speaker. I just want to make sure.
Okay.
Oh, thank you. So my question is a little bit differently than I worded it to Amy, but basically it's about how you might, as you're evangelizing from a Reformed perspective on soteriology, how can we think about our impact in using tools like philosophy and apologetics? As we're, I guess, just thinking about the idea that God's, chosen those he's chosen for salvation, and it doesn't mean that we don't do anything, but I'm Reformed in my thinking, but I've got people asking me, how do you...
Let me respond to that. I'm aware of the short time here because to me, I talk about this in chapter 2 of the tactics book. But to me, the role of philosophy and apologetics and good arguments and all of that play the same role as good theology and preaching the simple gospel and loving people into the kingdom. These are all noble ways that we seek to communicate in a gracious yet persuasive manner that God then uses for his purposes. I cannot convert anyone. The things that I'm against as a Christian are overwhelming. You have an unregenerate person who does not understand the things of God, who doesn't follow God, who is fighting against God, he doesn't even care about God, and who is a captive to the schemes of the devil who controls his mind. These are all Bible verses, all right? I've summed up a bunch of them in one line, okay? How am I going to defeat that? I can't. It is the Holy Spirit that has to do the work. Now, what are the means that the Holy Spirit uses to accomplish the end he has in mind? Well, the general means is the gospel. And the gospel isn't a sentence or two or three or a summation. It's a characterization of what God has done and what he offers to the non-Christian. That's what the gospel is. I mean, we can isolate it like Paul did in 1 Corinthians 15 in a number of different sentences to sum it up. But when the disciples are preaching the gospel, they are explaining these things to people. And this is constantly in the book of Acts, you see this, explaining and persuading and reasoning with them. So it is the communication of the good news, gospel, good news, in various ways that are accurate, clear, and persuasive. And then God does what he wants with our efforts. Therefore, all of these things, apologetics, philosophy, loving, the simple characterization of the gospel, theology, all of these things are noble means that God is free to use as he wants. And we use the means that we best are capable of using that are meet or appropriate for the moment.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's my sense of how it all works together.
Yeah, that's very helpful. Is there a minute for a tiny follow-up question?
Yeah, just about 2 minutes. Yeah.
So this is pretty direct, but I mean, because I know people have raised objections. Well, to me personally, can I still tell someone I'm evangelizing to that God loves them when they may not supremacy of the elect, let's say.
Of course you can. Because I think God does love them, all right. I think what you don't see, which is curious, you don't actually see that being done in the book of Acts. Take a moment and read the 13 different places the gospel is preached in the book of Acts, starting in chapter 2, and you're going to see something very different from what we characteristically do when we represent the gospel to other people. Now, I'm not saying we're always wrong. I'm just simply saying that the idea that you approach people on the basis of the love of God is not the main way that that those who are trained by Jesus approached people. In fact, they never approached people that way. In the book of Acts, the word love doesn't appear a single time. Now, certainly the love of God is manifest there, but so I don't know that that's the best way to approach. I'm kind of broadly in favor of bad news than good news, okay? And you let people know what, you know, the circumstances that they're under in rebellion against God, and you offer an antidote to that. Now, there are different ways to make appeals, and I'm not trying to just make it rigid, but people who don't care about insulin unless they get diabetes. And if a person doesn't believe that there's anything wrong in their life, then they're not going to try to rectify the wrong. And the wrong is rectifying the wrong is the first step to entering into a relationship with God and coming into His kingdom, so to speak. Make sense?
Okay, thank you.
All righty.
Yes, happy anniversary.
Thank you. That's so sweet of you. It's a great way to end the show. Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason. Give him heaven for another 28 years. What do you think? Bye-bye now.